From KCRW, I'm Bob Carlson, and this is Unfictional. Unfictional is a program of true stories, radio movies. And this season, we've been featuring stories about changes in perception. Seeing the world as someone else does. And this comes at a time when it seems like nobody wants to listen to opposing views. No one can reach understanding anymore, and everyone just shouts past each other. But on this episode, two different stories about trying to reach over the divide that keeps people from connecting. One story is about the way that two kids can be such tight friends and then grow into adults who barely recognize each other. But first, this story from producer Courtney Harrell. She's spent a big part of her life searching for her own universal language. From KCRW, it's Unfictional.
I used to say that if I could have any superpower, it would be to speak every language in the world. As a kid, I wished I had a built-in decoder. I wanted to hear any language and instantly understand the pattern that turned the sounds into meaning. I'd imagine everything I could do, people I could know, if I could communicate with everyone on the planet and really understand them. But when I talked to friends on the playground about this, or later, with boys out on dates, there was something I never told them. I had one particular language in mind that I wanted to speak, but I didn't know how to describe it. Starting in kindergarten, I had a Sunday morning ritual. I sat on my parents' bed while they got ready for church, and I watched televangelists on TV. My favorite part of the morning was the end of the service. Members of the congregation would line up in front of the stage, and the TV preacher would speak this nonsense language into the microphone. As he spoke, the pastor would walk down the line of people, touch each person on the forehead, and then, suddenly, that person would begin to speak their own nonsense language. Their faces would turn serious or excited. Sometimes they'd fall to the ground. I couldn't understand the words they were saying, but I could see that the language was powerful. This, my mom explained, was speaking in tongues. I was entranced by the power of the preacher's strange words. Every Sunday, I brought a congregation of Beanie Babies to the television and lined them up neatly in front of me on the comforter. As I watched, I would imitate the preacher. I'd lay my hand on the forehead of the little stuffed elephant, the bunny, the bear, and push them onto their backs along with the collapsing believers on TV. Then, I imagined, each of my animals would begin speaking in tongues.
All together, they were in one accord, and there came a sound from heaven like a rushing mighty wind, and they all received the Holy Ghost and began to speak in other tongues as the Spirit of God gave them the utterance.
Language is the way you understand me. It's how you look at another person and tell them who you are. It's how you go from being somebody's stranger to somebody's friend. So it makes sense that I've always wanted to speak in tongues, a language with not just the power of human connection, but one that connects you directly with God. Who wouldn't want that? But it's not the kind of language you can learn. It's a power, like flying or invisibility. It's something to be wished for. For years, every Sunday at church, I'd ask the Holy Spirit to let me speak in tongues.
Gotta ask for your Holy Spirit.
I tried different prayers and combinations, always looking for the magic word that would unlock my access to God.
Please let me speak in tongues.
It goes like this. You ask the Holy Spirit to give you the gift of speaking in tongues.
Give me your words.
You ask for the language, and if you get it, it's suddenly there, uploaded fully into you as a complete script.
Give me your words.
And then it just comes pouring out your mouth.
Give me your words.
When you speak in tongues, the voice is yours, but the language is God's. God decides what you pray, gives you the perfect thing to ask for, and all you have to do is say it. There's none of the thinking or planning or drafting and redrafting that normally comes before you can finally say what you mean. There's just the words, there, perfect and clear. It's the least you will ever be able to control your words and the most effective they will ever be. I started asking almost every night. Hiding in the back corner of my closet where I was sure nobody would hear me, I'd stay on my knees until my feet fell asleep and beg.
Please.
Everyone around me could do it. My parents, my friends. And every time I failed, there would be a question that would grow louder and louder in my mind. Was there a God who didn't want to connect me with his words? Or was there no God hearing my words at all? I began to hope that if I pretended to speak in tongues, it would eventually grow into something real. After school, I'd go to my bathroom, strip off my clothes, turn on the shower, and let the water soak me. I'd open my mouth and tell the spirit I was ready. When nothing happened, I invented the words myself. It was a lie, technically. But I meant every syllable as a prayer. I'd pray until my fingers pruned. I used to write stories about people who were saved by their faith. In a middle school journal covered in butterfly stickers, I wrote a story about a teenage girl, just a little older than me. She was trapped in a dystopian future where the world hated Christians. In fact, Christians like her were arrested for their beliefs. And in my story, I put the girl on trial. In the pivotal scene, she stands in the middle of a courtroom where a judge orders her to renounce her belief in Jesus or die. In this moment, my Christian girl speaks more convincingly of her faith than I was ever able to. She knows exactly what to say. And then, suddenly, as she's speaking, the spirit overtakes her, and her words turn into a heavenly language. I imagine what the language will feel like in her body. She loses control of her tongue, and she feels her fingers vibrate with the spirit. She feels full, sure of herself and her words. She gloats, filled with pride as the judge falls out of his seat, terrified of her divine superpower. I wrote this scene in my notebook again and again, over and over and over.
Speaking in Tongues was produced by Courtney Harrell, who's a producer for Pineapple Media. And coming up in a moment, when you ask yourself whatever happened to the coolest kid at summer camp, and then find the answer is, you don't want to know. From KCRW, this is Unfictional. From KCRW, I'm Bob Carlson, and this is Unfictional. And Lauren Cook has this argument why a crush from childhood should probably stay in childhood. A story called Strangers, in a good way. It's Unfictional.
I recently found a picture of myself. I was 12 years old. I had braces with orange-colored rubber bands. My bangs looked like a cloud of tumbleweed, and I had a huge smile on my face because I was holding my new troll doll. It was 1993. I was not cool. When I was this 12-year-old person, I went to sleepaway camp on a tiny island in the middle of the Chesapeake Bay called Smith Island. Because I haven't been there in so long, I Googled Smith Island last week, and I found a few current reviews on TripAdvisor. Number one, bugs, heat, and nothing to see. Number two, a total waste. Number three, interesting, comma, but disappointing at the same time. These were shocking for me to read, because my 12-year-old self remembers Smith Island as the greatest place on Earth. We rode bikes, canoed, went marsh mucking. The best thing about Smith Island, though, was Daryl. Daryl and I hit it off right away. We spent the whole 2 weeks laughing, playing basketball, and riding bikes side by side. He had a bad boy skater dude vibe, but with the dry humor of Wesley Owens from Mr. Belvedere. We bonded over the fact we had the same favorite song. It was so romantic. The two of us were obviously made for each other. It was tough to say goodbye on the last day of camp, but I got his address, and as soon as I got home, I wrote him a long, heartfelt letter. 2 days later, I started checking the mailbox for his reply. I had a month left before school started, and the entire time I was either rollerblading my neighborhood alone, watching Oprah, or checking the mail multiple times a day for a letter from Daryl. I got letters from a couple other friends, but I ached for the one from Daryl. Sadly, the letter never came. Not until 8 months later, when out of the blue, miracle of miracles, I got a reply. Dear Lauren, right now, you might be a little surprised of what the date is because I am just now writing you. Hello, how are you? I am fine. One reason I'm just now writing to you is, all caps, my whole life is a mess. He goes on about soccer and school. On the third page is when it gets good. About camp. Me and you were the only cool people there. I still remember when we were painting the boat and you got white paint in my hair. Your pal, Daryl. Well, 12-year-old me was elated. This letter was perfect. His choice of words, the awesome drawings in the margins of each page, beyond my wildest dreams. I got a lot of letters from Daryl after that. We became full-fledged pen pals. And every time a letter would arrive, my heart would burst with adrenaline. I would run to my room, shut the door, and read it over and over. Looking back at the letters now, they're mostly filled with what Daryl likes and doesn't like. For instance, a now 13-year-old Daryl likes the word wicked, which he defines as, quote, cool in a death sense. 13-year-old Daryl does not like how small his locker is. He mentions the size and inconvenience of his locker more than anything else in the letters, hands down. He also dislikes Courtney Love. He wants her to be thrown in jail, but he doesn't want her to die because where would Frances Bean go? The greatest things about the letters actually are the envelopes. They're covered in these beautiful drawings of random stuff, like an eight ball and the 9-inch nails downward spiral. He uses Stussy-inspired lettering to write Crash Test Dummies Rule and No Fear. He was a moody 90s Alterna poster boy, my favorite category of person. Sometimes I'd get a letter every few weeks, and then 6 months would go by. But we kept our correspondence going through middle school into high school. Here's what I find interesting. The entire time, we were half an hour drive away from each other. 30 minutes. And we never once met up. We talked on the phone a few times, but it was mainly letters for over 4 years. Maybe it was safer that way. To me, Daryl was this protected secret friend. No matter what else was going wrong in life, and things were definitely going wrong in life, I still had a pile of funny letters from a guy I thought was really cool. Eventually, time passed and I forgot about Daryl. I didn't think about him until last Thanksgiving. I found an old box my mom had been keeping for me filled with every letter he'd ever sent. It took me about 2 seconds to start stalking him online. The first picture I found of Daryl was not what I expected. It was a picture of a huge guy wearing a t-shirt that read, "Keep America American, Peace Through Superior Firepower." He was wearing a MAGA hat. Oh, God, no. Daryl is an enthusiastic Trump supporter, and he loves guns. He loves guns so much, his Instagram is almost 100% guns. In one, he's wearing a wife beater that says, "American as fuck." Another, a sweatshirt, "Fuck ISIS." He often tags his location at a shooting range with captions like, "Getting down with the hashtag AK and hashtag 2 Amendment. There's hashtag truck porn, hashtag shall not be infringed, hashtag fuck your feelings, hashtag blue lives matter, hashtag don't come to my house uninvited. And then, my favorite, a picture of his massive hand holding both a gun and a red and green donut with the caption, "I get excited for Christmas, hashtag guns and donuts, hashtag my fave holiday, hashtag diet goes to shit during the holidays." Like most people in LA, I'm on the other team. My social media is filled with memes of Putin as Trump's leather daddy, protest signs that say impeach the racist leech, a drawing of Ruth Bader Ginsburg kayaking past a shark that I framed for my daughter's bedroom, that type of thing. So I guess there's the romance of what we remember, and then there's reality. I tell myself, Daryl's no longer the person he used to be. He's like the TripAdvisor review of Smith Island. Interesting, but disappointing at the same time. But there's this part of me that needs to know. Even though I'm a grown-ass married lady with a baby and I love my life and my husband more than anything, I'm so curious. How did Daryl become the comic book version of my worst nightmare? And what would he think of me? Impulsively, I write him a Facebook message and hit send. Then I friend him and follow him on Facebook and Instagram. Then I take a walk around the block without my phone because I'm freaking out. Surprisingly, he replies fairly quickly. He follows me back on both accounts, we exchange a few messages, and we even arrange a time to talk on the phone and catch up. This is happening fast. Suddenly, it's the morning I'm supposed to call him, and I'm feeling a lot of conflicting emotions. A, I'm scared. Are we going to have a hostile conversation? B, I'm anxious and giddy about contacting the person whose letters used to make me swoon. It's not rational. C, I'm grateful to him. He's agreed to give up his Sunday afternoon to have a conversation with a person he may not even remember. And D, I'm hot, like physically hot. I am sitting in the garage so my baby can nap. I have a sitter for an hour, so we're rushed for time. It's 100 degrees in LA. I'm sweating so much. Point is, there's a lot going on for me. What could possibly go wrong?
Hey.
It's kind of dark there.
We immediately discover my recording program requires me to use FaceTime, but I've blocked my camera with a sticker because
I felt like I was going to get really distracted if we had to look at each other.
Now he's looking at a black screen and I'm looking at his face. I have to take the sticker off, but I really don't want to because I have a toddler. I'm not prepared to be seen by anyone, especially not Daryl.
I'm here. No, I'll... Yeah, no, I put the thing over.
Cool. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Holy shit, you sort of look the same.
He does look the same. Aside from his beard, he looks exactly the way I remember him.
I remember going to camp.
Okay.
I remember bringing bikes to camp.
Yes.
My mom said that all my clothes were just covered in mud.
I mean, I remember riding bikes. I remember playing basketball.
Were we in the mud a lot?
Yes, like, we were in the mud a lot.
Finding clams or something?
Marsh mucking.
I don't remember anybody else.
Really?
There. I don't remember any other...
But do you actually remember me at all?
Yes.
Because we wrote letters for like 4 years.
We wrote letters till like I went away to military school in high school.
I ask how he ended up at military school.
Fighting and drugs.
Yeah.
Stuff like that, but
yeah.
You know, when you watch your parents go through a divorce and I feel like we've talked about this in letters. Like how people, 12, 13, 14, 15, they find some support system on the internet. I guess me and you found each other through camp.
No, no, I remember I was like very excited for your letters. And I would
feel
be
like
writing...
I was the same way.
Really?
Okay, so when the tumbleweed bangs part of me heard Daryl considered me as a support through a rough time, that he waited for my letters the way I waited for his, that was sweet. I read him a few of the letters I'd kept.
You hated Courtney Love. You wanted her to be thrown in jail. But you didn't want her to die because then where would Francis Bean go?
Did I say for why?
I don't... Well,
when I ask him why he thinks we never hung out in person, he remembers plans being made. They just didn't pan out.
You know, I was probably a prick and driving and drugs and stuff like that.
I don't think you were a prick. You never seemed like a prick.
After military school, Daryl started taking classes at a community college, but he felt kind of lost, like he was wasting his time. So after 9/11, he enlisted in the Marines.
First time in my life, I ended up doing really well.
His job in Afghanistan was to be a javelin gunner, which means he would run out with a huge missile on his shoulder. It's a man versus tank situation.
This was the first thing you did.
Mm-hmm.
So you're like 21 at this
time? I turned 21 in Marine Corps boot camp. Which is literally like the worst.
Yeah.
On June 8th of 2004, Daryl was awarded a Purple Heart after he got shot in the ankle. Then, in 2005, he went to Iraq, to Fallujah, where he lost his closest friend.
Oh, man.
So, he was from Portland, Oregon. And his name's tattooed on my chest. Like, to this day, I can't go to his grave.
2 months later, Daryl got out of the Marines. He was drinking a lot. He got in a bad car accident and broke his neck. And that's when he realized he had PTSD. But since then, he's gotten help. He's moved back closer to his family, gotten a master's degree, and last year he got married. He seems really good.
Okay, cool. Yeah, so you like it? You like your job?
Yeah, I like the normal life that I have.
Here's the thing. I made the presumption I would be facing some toxic masculinity during this conversation. I thought Daryl would be shut off. But he's the opposite. Whether he's talking about growing up the child of a tough divorce, losing his best friend, addiction, he's willing to share a lot. And he wants to know about me, too. How I like being a mom.
It's really fun. It's like, it's the best thing in the world. It's also, it's definitely the hardest thing, but it's the best thing.
Super pumped.
Yeah.
I'm super excited. We're trying to get pregnant now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, probably should have did it a little bit earlier. I feel like I'm like too old to have a kid now, but.
You're not.
After talking so much, I feel conflicted. Do I really want to bring up politics? Maybe this should be it. But I need to bring up politics.
Well, the only other thing I was going to ask you about, just because I think it's funny that we've had such different lives and we were really good buddies for a long time, even though we just wrote letters. But, I mean, we've both seen each other's social media accounts and mm-hmm. we're, like, on the opposite side of the political spectrum.
Yeah, you're lefter than I am.
Yeah. Yeah, by a lot, I think.
I have MAGA hats over there. Trump says all the right things, as far as I'm concerned. Open borders, I don't agree with.
Uh-huh.
I agree with a wall. I agree with if people want to come here, they need to do it the right way. Because I've had a lot of friends in the Marine Corps that had to, in order to come here and to bring kids here that they served, and that's how they became a citizen.
I mean, like, I don't know. We could definitely argue about this stuff for a long time. I believe in asylum, though, for people who need to escape a desperate situation. I mean, like, the separation of the kids thing has been brutal.
True. And I agree with you. And without arguing with you. There are eight to 10 places that you can go along the border where you can apply for asylum or apply for something or whatever it is. And if you don't go that way, then you're not doing it the right way.
Okay.
We talked for a long time. We talked about everything, gun control, the coastal elite, the opioid crisis. We talked about urban crime, bad cops, caging children. We had a few breakthroughs. There were tons of times we both said, I agree with you. When we said goodbye, we agreed we wanted to stay in touch. We wanted to be buddies.
I feel like the only way that people have a conversation like me and you are having now, is if they don't do it on the internet.
Right.
As strangers.
No, I think you're exactly right. I think when you actually talk.
If people actually talked face to face, or if people wrote letters.
People need to write letters.
If people would write some letters.
Yeah.
It might be a little bit easier.
I think you're right.
You're probably my oldest friend.
It's been weird for the last 2 years to feel the obligation, the desire even, to wake up angry. Because there's so much to be angry about. But then to make sure everyone else is angry too. Did you see this? Aren't you livid? You should be more livid. And there's no solution. You can't stop being angry because that means you're giving up. So it did feel like a breath of fresh air that Daryl and I, we reconnected and remembered each other fondly first. But we were also strangers in a good way. We wanted to be polite. We wanted to see things from each other's perspectives. And then 24 hours later, I felt a huge wave of guilt. I let him off too easy. I should have asked him this or pointed out that example. I sympathized with him, but does he ever sympathize with the 10-year-old trans kid, with the Guatemalan mother who still hasn't been reunited with her son? And then I told myself, it's not too late. We can have these conversations. I can call him. I can text him. We can continue this back and forth. A few weeks after my big phone call with Daryl, though, Judge Kavanaugh was accused of sexually assaulting Christine Blasey Ford. A day or two before the hearings, I posted a screenshot of part of an open letter signed by over 1,000 women from Blasey Ford's high school saying they supported her and believed her account because, quote, it was all too consistent with stories they heard and lived while attending Houlton. Daryl couldn't help it, I guess. Despite his argument that the internet is the worst, he trolled my post and left a shitty comment. Quote, Kavanaugh will be confirmed before the midterms because of baseless accusations, which ultimately just lessens the plight of actual sexual assault / rape victims. And I hope when Ginsey kicks the bucket, Trump puts a strong conservative woman on the bench just to make Lib's head spin. We haven't spoken since. I want to have hope our perspectives will change again, that we'll be able to agree enough that we can not hate each other, because that felt nice. I want to have hope, like the sad kid who checks her mailbox 4 times a day. But I'm not that kid anymore.
Strangers in a Good Way was written by Lauren Cook and edited by Nick White and Carla Green. It was mixed and scored by Ray Guarna. I'm Bob Carlson, the producer of Unfictional. The managing producer of the program is Carla Green. The editor is Nick White. Theme music by Alex Weston, with music help from Joe Augustine and Narrative Music. The whistler is Jonathan May. On the next episode of Unfictional, the legendary witch who will steal your children and turn them into lotions and unguents.
She's the witch. She's the witch from the tales. But the witch come true.
I'm Bob Carlson. Please subscribe to this program wherever you listen to podcasts and join me next time for Unfictional on KCRW.